All right, if you've listened this far, you know the deal. The book that came out of this podcast is called How the Internet Happened, From Netscape to the iPhone by me, available wherever fine books are sold. Also, the podcast I do these days is called The Tech Meme Ride Home. Search any podcast app for Ride Home, and you should find The Tech Meme Ride Home, which is all the day's tech news every weekday in just 15 minutes. If you like this show, you'll love that one.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Welcome to the Internet History Podcast. I'm your host, Brian McCullough. So, to follow up after last week's conversation with Karl-Heinz Brandenburg, we're going to talk today with another person who was responsible for the MP3 revolution. I actually didn't think we'd get to MP3s for a while, until the Napster period in about the year 2000, but while I was researching Karl-Heinz Brandenburg and the birth of the MP3, I realized, or perhaps remembered, that MP3s were a growing force in the years before Napster. And one of the reasons the MP3 was a growing force was because of a software program called Winamp, which was developed by Justin Frankel. As a part of my research, I reached out to Justin on Twitter, and it turned out that we're essentially neighbors in Brooklyn, so there was basically no reason not to go ahead and speak with him right away. So even though this is a bit ahead of things in chronology, in a way, it isn't. Recorded in the conference room of my offices in Dumbo, this is the first time I've attempted that, so let me know if the sound quality is bad. Here is a conversation with Justin Frankel, the founder of Winamp and Nullsoft. Justin Frankel, thanks for coming on the Internet History Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Actually, we always start off with personal background. Funny enough, I think you're the first person that I've interviewed that's not been at least 10 or 15 years older than me. You were born in 78, right?
That's right.
Class of 96?
That's also right.
Exactly the same age.
Statistically, you're probably slightly older than me then. I was born in October.
So. Okay, February, but still.
So those 6 months make a big difference when you're in high school.
That's true, but it's interesting to suddenly be talking to someone with the same chronological context, basically. So you grew up in Sedona, Arizona.
That's right. It's the land of red rocks and crystals and flying saucers and aliens. That's about it, yeah.
Given that we do share chronologically the same age, give me your computer machine history, like Atari, Commodore 64, Apple IIe in school, like what were we dealing with?
My older brothers had an Atari 800 XL that they got when I was probably 5 or 6, somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of what I originally started playing with. My first experience with a computer that lasted for more than an hour at the library or something like that. And from there, you know, I programmed in BASIC and saw my older brother's program. And then when my parents got a 386 SX, I sort of picked it up again. And at that point, started doing things in Turbo Pascal and then later in Turbo C. Classic Borland products.
Right. So I guess you like doing that enough that the goal is to do computer science when you go to college?
Yeah, I mean, I did a lot of programming in high school and actually was put in a position where I got to run sort of administer the student eval network. And the school didn't really have a lot of software for it, so I ended up writing programs for students to use. And one of which was like an email program just that could be used locally within the network. And, I think it's the wrong amount, but it was used locally by the students in the network. And so I actually got the experience in high school of writing software and getting feedback from users and sort of getting that experience, which is really satisfying for me at least. And make software, find it very enjoyable. So.
Right. But you only last two semesters. Where was the college?
So I went to the University of Utah after I graduated high school and went for two quarters. And I injured myself the summer before college, like rollerblading, doing something really stupid. Missed the opportunity to test out at the entry-level CS classes. So the CS classes I took in college were incredibly boring. I would often harass the teacher by, like, when he would say things that weren't technically correct, you know, sort of calling out and saying, well, that's not really true. And didn't really get friends with my professor, sorry, but David Hansen. I enjoyed other things. I enjoyed writing and physics and stuff, but I was just really bored and just felt like going home. So I ended up quitting college. And around that time, one of my friends in school had made an MP3 player for the Mac called MacAmp. And,
was that Dimitri?
That was Dimitri. And so he did that, and he was showing it to me, and you know, I had been downloading MP3s prior to that, and so it was cool that something that, you know, writing software that was playing back MP3 files was within the grasp of something that could be figured out how to do. And so when I got back from college and moved back to my parents, I didn't really move out. You know, it was in a dorm room, so. But when I went back home, then what I started doing was writing my first, like, real Windows program, which ended up being Winamp.
So you hadn't really programmed very much in Windows before that?
No, I'd done a few little test applications, but nothing that really would qualify as...
The prompting was that he had done MacAmp, and
yeah.
So why not do a Winamp?
Right. I mean, I'd used Windows, sure. And when, at that point, Windows 95 was something, like, when Windows 95 first came out, I don't think I even had a computer that could run it. And then, you know, by that point, everyone did, and it was very popular. And so it was like, oh, well, here's something new to learn to write a proper Windows application. Here's something to do. And half the battle of programming is just figuring out something that you can do that's within your skill set, but still interesting enough to be worthwhile.
Well, let's back up for a second, though, because... I think everyone, again, of our age, whatever, had this experience. I know, all of a sudden, I went back to school 1 year, like maybe after Christmas, so it would have been 97, maybe beginning of 98, and all of a sudden, Winamp and MP3s are everywhere, and before they hadn't been. But obviously, you had to have gotten into MP3s sooner than that.
Yeah.
So do you remember that, like, discovering, because if, I think Karl-Heinz Brandenburg told me that the Fraunhofer Society had released their first, what would it have been, the encoding program or something, maybe in 95 or something. So just remember for me how you discovered MP3s and the proliferation and that sort of thing.
You know, I don't recall how I first became aware of MP3s. However, years before that, there were MP2 files, which were MPEG Layer 2. And they were quite a bit larger and didn't sound quite as good for the size. There was like the Internet Underground Music Archive, and it was an FTP site. You could go and you could find all these different indie artists and download their music. So at a certain point, I downloaded, I think it was a Bumble Surfer song. And,
Pepper.
Yes. And, you know, there was a, IRC was a big communication mechanism that was used by a lot of people. I guess today people still use it, though. Probably the same number of people then as today. So on IRC, I remember seeing a link to MP3s, and there was a channel that was pound MPEG3, spelled MPEG3. That was a channel that I ended up joining and participating a lot in. And these were all people who were downloading and also encoding MP3s. And so once I was in that channel, that was initially the real first audience for Winamp, was when I would make versions of it. These would be the people who would be testing it, giving feedback and saying, well, you should make it play a playlist, or you should make it do this sort of thing. So at some point, I found it was probably on an FTP site, the Bubble Server song, and downloaded it, and was impressed with the quality of it. And that was probably late 1996, if I had to guess.
So how long would you say it took you to... The very first version of Winamp didn't have... It was very bare bones, right?
Yeah.
It didn't have the skins and the playlists and things like that. How long do you think it took you to program that first version?
Well, so I started by taking this open source decoder called AMP, which was made by a guy in Croatia, and a bunch of other people contributed, but it was like, it was his research project for probably a PhD or something like that. And so the first version I did of it, actually before that I did a DOS version called DOSAMP, which was, admittedly, there are very few people who really wanted to use it, I suppose. But I had written a bunch of code for DOS, a bunch of sort of gaming and demo scene related code. So it was sort of a natural fit to just put a lot of that to work. And so I made the DOS version, and eventually in early 97, I started doing the first versions of Winamp. And it went really fast. I mean, I think to 1.0, it probably took 2 or 3 months. Mm-hmm.
And it was always famous for being also a very thin client in terms of, we all complain about iTunes bloat now and stuff like that, but yours was always famous for, was that something that your code's always, you've always been good with, like being really efficient with things like that?
That's probably a subject of art that could be of debate. I think for me it was largely that there were all sorts of frameworks you could use, like MFC, or you could use a bunch of third-party libraries. And I would try to avoid having to do that, mostly because it's more work, but also I just liked writing sort of basic Windows applications.
So at this point, you're back home with your parents in Arizona, and you throw up this program for your friends on the IRC channel, and you throw the program up completely free. Like, you're not even asking for donations at the beginning, right?
Right. It was just a project for fun. And at some point when I was, I don't remember what point along, I'd probably figure it out, but at some point my parents were asking me questions like, well, how many people are using this? And we had a website so people could download it, and so you could see how many people were downloading it. And they wanted me to make some money so that I would be slumming in their bedroom. But
your dad's a lawyer, right?
Yeah.
Well,
he's retired now. But so they were like, oh, we should charge people, and so I sort of went with something closer to the WinZip model. Better piece of software no one
right.
uses anymore.
But very fond memories of.
Yeah, which was basically so that people are technically supposed to send in $10, but there was no actual mechanism to respond to.
However, belying the famous notion that no one ever pays for shareware stuff, so how quickly are you making like $100,000 a month just from these $10 checks coming in?
I don't think it ever got to that point.
Okay.
But it was definitely, you don't need that much money to have a good time, really.
People were actually paying because they were loving Winamp so much.
Yeah. And, most of it was done online with credit cards as opposed to checks. There were a fair number of checks, and people would send cash in the mail as well. But yeah, I mean, it made a decent amount of money. And the website got enough traffic as well. And I think early on we did just some very simple deal with mp3.com to give them impressions. And I think they were paying like a dollar CPM, which was, I guess, a pretty low price at the time. I don't know what it is now. But and that quickly added up to actually be as much as the registrations were thereabouts.
Where did It Really Whips the Llama's Ass come from? Is it that's a Wesley Willis?
It is. It must have come via. Oh yeah, I recall that. It was so one of the guys who was involved early on was Tom Pepper, and I think he did the initial artwork for Winamp, and then he also made a website. He at the time worked for a service provider, and so he had all sorts of know-how and resources for putting websites on the internet, which at the time was like still sort of a black art. Even just registering a domain name in the late 90s was like not the easiest thing in the world to do. It was, of course, now it's nothing. It's $10. And
right. Yeah.
But so he was involved, and I think someone at some point sent an email saying It Really Whips the Llama's Ass, talking about Winamp, or it might have been talking about MacAmp even.
Mm.
So someone, I think, actually was quoting Wesley Willis in his email. And I think that he put that quote up on the website at some point. And at the time, I don't know if he knew. I definitely didn't know who Wesley Willis was.
Mm.
But it just sort of stuck.
Yeah.
And then at some point, we made an Easter egg that you could type in Nullsoft, and then the title bar would change to show, instead of saying Winamp, it would say Really Whips the Llama's Ass. And then I think eventually, you know, we just embraced it and had J.J. McKay, who did all these, he has that radio voice, did the MP3 that came with it, etc.
And Nullsoft is a play on Microsoft. Is it that if Microsoft is micro, you're basically nothing? Is that the play?
Yeah, it's just, it had more or less that, and also just when I originally started using it, there wasn't a company. There was just me like making random programs, and so it was just a appropriate name.
So how long after you first released it did you actually form Nullsoft? Was it within the year or?
I think we incorporated in January of 98, okay. So it was
a little less
than a year. Yeah. But you know, we were making money before then. It was just like a DBA or something. Proprietorship.
Let's get in, before we get to the crazy stuff, let's talk a little bit about the development. So you're basically just taking feedback from users and you're starting to add things like the ability to do playlists, the ability to get the ID tags and things like that, the ability to scan your hard drive and create a library and stuff like that. Is this all coming from user feedback and things like that?
Actually, I should mention that scanning your hard drive for a library, that actually came way later. Early on, we would sort of we never really did that. We just let people manage their playlists and import, export. Other things that we did that were really sort of unique and new were doing a real-time equalizer. No one had that. Doing visualizations. That had been done by some old DOS. There was like Cubic Player, which was a mod player for DOS that had like a nice spectrum analyzer and stuff like that.
Or this is, I always used to think, because this is the day of like screensavers and stuff, so like that's what you did, is you just let your computer sit there and play images. Like I wondered if maybe that had come from that or something.
Yeah,
it was in the air.
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't unprecedented, but just the integration of all these things. Those were the things. And a lot of that was from my own like personal desire, and then a lot of it's from feedback.
The skinning, without trying to put words in your mouth, like how important do you think that was to the popularity eventually it went in?
I don't know. It's hard to say. I you know, I think a lot of people found it really entertaining. You know, the story of that is that people were actually using resource editors to change the images within the application and distributing like new executables that had the different skin. And so the problem was is people would use that, and then every time we would update the versions, which early on in the life of it was very often, people would have to reapply these images. So at a certain point, we just decided to make it like a separate thing and skinny. We didn't invent like the idea, but it was that users did, and we're like, okay, well, let's make that a little easier for them. But yeah, it's hard to know how that affects popularity. It is the kind of thing where I think, and we've gone through this, the software I make now is also themeable. And for a few years, it was a very big thing for people to make themes. And then it sort of, that's faded off and people don't care less. The current software I do now, it's like, I think a lot of that's due to the fact that the theme that comes with now is so much better than what it came with 5 years ago. That people now are just like, oh, this looks nice. Why would I change anything? Whereas before, they were like, oh, I want it to look like fancier, cleaner, or something like that. But for Winamp, I don't really know. It's hard to know, you know, what would have happened if it hadn't been skinnable. But it definitely, there was a great community around it as a result of that. The people on our forums who like to talk and share, and it definitely was beneficial for that, but hard to know how that really affected.
Right. Well, the other thing that I remember, I'm just using my own personal recollections for this, but like, you obviously weren't the first people to do plugins and things like that, but that willingness to do skins, allow plugins and stuff so people could do precisely what they wanted to do with your stuff. The idea of plugins, did that also come from people badgering you, I want to do this, I want to do that, and you just let them do it?
You know, I don't remember exactly. I think a lot of it was just wanting to experiment, but not wanting to mess with the core and worry about breaking things before. And then it's also, I think just the general laziness of wanting to let other people do more work. So,
Winamp is released in '97, and So you had to have like your finger right on the pulse of when the MP3 explosion happened. Like, are you able to see that where, oh, we've got 30,000 users, that's pretty nice. Well, we've got 300,000, and then you're reaching the millions. Like, were you able to feel that riding the groundswell of the MP3 taking off and going mainstream?
I don't know. I mean, I think our exposure to it was limited in that we were just... I was never really sort of trying to be on the edge of that. Mm-hmm. It was more just making software and seeing people use it and sort of having that relationship and having... Like,
let me ask this
experience
a different way then.
Sure, yeah.
Same kind of question, but asked a different way. By 1998, in our dorm rooms and stuff, everyone was playing their music on Winamp. Did you have that experience where all of a sudden people you don't know, you're encountering Winamp out in the world and hey, everybody seems to be using this. Did you have that level of it's blowing up kind of thing?
Occasionally, yeah. Mm-hmm. Which is very gratifying.
Mm-hmm. So when do you have to take it from it's just you to this is a company, maybe I need to bring on other people? When does that happen?
Well, early on, I actually was contacted by a guy named Rob Lord, who actually started the Internet Underground Music Archive before that. And I think he worked for some part of some record label or some tech, some place in LA, I think. Anyway, and he was very interested in it and saw, I think, a lot of potential he saw that MP3 sort of the revolution or the bigness of it, and wanted to had all sorts of ambitions of doing things. And I think if he had been able to do everything he wanted to do, and had the right position, he probably would have been where Apple is with, you know, the iPod and so on. Or Apple was, I guess. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
So
he knew where they were going. But he had that ambition. And he pushed to do a lot of things that would be, you know, very beneficial from a, like, growth and presence. And, you know, when the first Flash-based MP3 players came out, he wanted to do, like, branded versions of that and to go and sort of embrace and expand. And I was always just like, you know, I just want to make software. I don't want to have to do all this stuff. I don't want to sort of compromise that experience by sort of expanding to, like, a business. And, you know, I was reluctant to advertise it.
Well, and I had read from his version of events that he almost has to say, hey, let me try some stuff. And you're like, all right, knock yourself out. And then all of a sudden he's coming back with, like, you know, advertising deals and stuff like this. Is that?
Yeah, yeah. And or maybe not knock yourself out, but, like, yeah, we'll see. And then
okay.
He comes back and you're like, okay.
Yeah.
And so on. I think I like to think of myself as a capitalist, but I'm also just, I think, really, I don't know, it's more about the craftsmanship. And when you start getting too much into the business side of things, I don't enjoy it anymore. So ultimately, that, I think, held us back a decent amount.
Unfortunately, we have to get into the business stuff in a second, but I'm curious.
It's fine to talk about it. I don't like to compromise the thing I'm making
right
for some business reason, because it just is.
Was there a version of Winamp that, like, you have a particular fondness for? It's not asking which was the best version, but is there one where you're like, man, that's really where I hit really what I wanted to do with it?
Not really. I mostly used the last version that we released before I left AOL, which is like 5.08 or something like that.
So we're going to weave our way towards AOL. So if I'm going to throw numbers at you, which you don't have to confirm or remember even, but so within 18 months of Winamp being released, apparently you hit around 15 million downloads or users or something like that.
Sounds plausible.
And so at some point, big boys have to start taking notice. And so this would be into late 98, maybe into 99. I have to imagine that AOL wasn't the only company that started sniffing around you guys. Were there lots of others?
We talked to a few others, and actually, it looked like we were going to be acquired by someone else.
Are you able to?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know what happened. Probably safer not to. Say another company in, like, Sunnyvale or something. So that happened. They sniffed around, and then that apparently raised some flags with the people who had licensed or who had taken over the rights to the MP3 decoder that we originally used.
Right.
And so they basically, before anything could happen, they filed suit against us. I guess they wanted a piece of the pie.
This is Play Media, and they filed a suit because they know that people are sniffing around you?
I don't know what I can really say about that, because it subsequently settled, and
right,
there was all sorts of confidentiality, blah, blah, blah. But basically, I think they were a little concerned that they weren't going to get payday.
Gotcha. And so after that case, you switch ISO decoders over to the Fraunhofer?
Yeah. Software. What happened was originally we used AMP, and then we, at a certain point, they renegotiated license terms with us, and we took the opportunity to write in a new decoder. And there were, I guess, enough similarities in rewriting something that does the exact same thing, where they felt that it wasn't leaving room enough or something. Paris, there probably wasn't because I contributed to AMP, and so like there was enough involvement that there wasn't any copying of code, but there was enough experience with other code that these similarities were an issue. And so, and then switching to the ISO decoder was because at that point it was AOL and they had lots of money.
Well,
or not the ISO, but the front offer decoder.
Right. So, I don't read into this question anything, but why go with AOL? Now, having said that, this is at the height of AOL's, the colossus of the internet.
Honestly, the lawsuit was a big problem. It was, we originally were talking to other people, and AOL came in and said, here's a chunk of money. This is for a clean company. You figure out how to, how to pay to make it a clean company, and whatever's left, you get to keep. And so that's what we did. And it was, we were making a decent amount of money, but just to go through the motions of defending a litigation is incredibly expensive. And so it was an easy decision to make.
I've read that you said at one point that you did have a brief honeymoon at AOL.
Yeah.
But I imagine this is also your first time sort of...
No, AOL was great initially, mm-hmm. and I think they had the best of intentions. Ted Leonsis, who was the main guy who I would talk to when I had an issue, he was always so wanting to make everything right, wanting to do interesting, good things. But the reality was, as a company, those things weren't necessarily possible, and it wasn't just us. It was the way they worked.
Well, and also, they acquire Spinner at the same time, right?
Yeah.
Literally simultaneously?
I think the same day.
And so the idea is to merge all of this together and make a run at... which makes sense because, obviously, especially after the Time Warner merger, they would have access to all this content and things like that, so...
This was maybe a year...
A year before.
Before the merger was announced, even.
Right?
So, yeah, I mean, I think they wanted to have some involvement in music on the internet, this was their move to do that. Having said that, I don't know if they really knew what that would be. I think they were essentially buying.
That was the era for that, just buying whatever. Yeah.
We part of the deal was we didn't have to go to Virginia, which was attractive, so we went to San Francisco. And we shared an office with Spinner. And Spinner had been in that office for probably a month before we got there. So, guessing anyway. So, in their minds, they sort of acquired us. And then at the same time, we're acquired by
In Spinner's mind.
Okay. So, there was that mentality, which was made things a little more difficult. Probably also shielded us from who knows what from AOL, but it was, made it more abstracted.
So, is it after you're at AOL that you first encounter Napster?
Yeah. I remember the first time I saw it. I think it was around that time. Yeah, it was really cool. I remember seeing it and the conversation being, wow, how long is this going to last? And what was really interesting about it is that it was really small until they got sued or until the recording industry went after them. And that's when it blew up.
The classic, what is it, the Barbara Streisand effect, once they got all the headlines, then all of a sudden everyone knows about it and it creates the problem that they're trying to trying to head off. Yeah. But what's key to understand in the context here is, so if there's this brief window of time where it seems like everybody is suddenly getting their music from Napster, the thing that everybody's playing this music on is Winamp. So in a way, very quickly, Winamp and Napster sort of are this symbiotic kind of software package.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I guess it expands the ecosystem.
Right.
But, no, it was interesting to see Napster do it because we also were like, well, we should be doing this.
Right.
And so we actually like thought about that, and one of the things, like going back into the history of Winamp, one of the things that we had to deal with was at a certain point file associations were a big deal. You would install RealPlayer and it would take over your MP3 associations, and so you know people would get like, I'm used to double clicking on this and then opening Winamp, and now it's opening RealPlayer. So one of the things we did was make a program that would just run in the background and just manage your file association so that if something, if you installed something else and took them over, it would take them back. And so one of the things we did at this point was that we did an experiment where we put a web server inside the Winamp agent, as it was called, and made it an option. I don't think we ever released it, but it was a test, an option so you could have it scan all of your music and then make it accessible via a web interface. And then you could stream it to other instances of Winamp if you want. And the idea was that we could also make it send a list of the database to some AOL server that ran, you know, some Oracle database that we figured out if we had, 100,000 people or 500,000 people sign up for this and, you know, decide to use it, and they each had a collection of 1,000 tracks, like this server would cost just a ridiculous amount. Anyway, so we like sort of designed this whole system, and we're like, no, we can never do this. I mean, AOL has deep pockets. They they would release something like this, it would be bad. But
well, you guys become friendly with the Napster guys at some point, right?
Yeah. Well, I've met Sean Fanning a number of times, four times than I can count. He actually was. I know him from. Car scene, you know, the Mazda RX-7. At that point, I don't think I really know. I hadn't known it from IRC as well. So we looking at that and basically knew that we couldn't really do anything like Napster. There's a rumor on the internet, which I think is true, which is that Rob Lord at a certain point told someone at RIAA about Napster.
Told RIAA about Napster that it existed, or that, hey, this is a problem for you, like,
check this out kind of thing.
What would be his motivation for that?
I think it might have been to just sort of get going what was going to happen eventually, or to see if it was going to be something viable.
So
I don't really know. I don't know. Sorry, Rob, if I'm misremembering things, I'm really sorry.
We're
talking about the possibility of that anyway.
Maybe a little competitive juices or something, like,
sure,
this is what we should be doing.
There's probably, you know, I probably felt that at a certain point, I wasn't in AOL.
Obviously, whether they were tipped off by him or not, the RIAA goes after them pretty quickly. Did they ever come to talk to you guys? Was there ever any meetings, like strong arming or threats or anything like that from them?
I don't think so. Not to my knowledge, but there was also the RIAA sued Diamond Multimedia for the Rio player,
right.
Flash player, which was a kind of abuse of.
It would seem ridiculous that they would even think that they could sue you because on what grounds? But as you say, they were going everywhere, bazooka style. So,
and also, I mean, it was new, so they were like, "Oh, this is, you know, this is the future of piracy, and we must stop it." And thankfully, you know, that didn't hold up. I mean, it held up, and that they didn't do well, but we at least have an iPod.
Right.
Came out of that.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
This is like a GIF thing. Nutella, Nutella.
I don't really see a difference in that.
So
some people would probably call it the hazelnut spread Nutella or Nutella.
Right. So
I guess the question is the G silent.
Right.
Nutella or
no, not ever. If you don't know, then it doesn't really matter, does it?
Should ask Tom Pepper that.
Okay.
Came up with that.
So is it you've said to yourself, gee, what Napster is achieving is kind of what I kind of wish we were doing. So is that,
well,
is it your idea or Tom Pepper or together you're like, let's do something similar?
I would say that I don't know if we wished we were doing it, but it was an interesting thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it also did feel sort of like I agreed that the functionality should be something that people had access to, but I didn't necessarily think that it should be a business.
Mm-hmm.
And so Nutella was an attempt to make a piece of software that was a service that no one controlled and no one would benefit from other than the people using it. And it was ultimately my idea of how do you make something that exists just kind of software that can connect to each other.
Because the difference between Nutella and Napster is that there's not centralized servers.
Yeah.
It's completely decentralized.
Napster works by having a server that when you ran the Napster software, it would connect to the server, establish your presence on it, and send a list of all your music. And the server would then build a big database that allowed other users to search it. And then if the other users wanted to download something, they would connect to you directly. So they weren't actually transmitting music files around in Napster, but they were transmitting the index.
So technically not technically peer-to-peer?
No, it's peer-to-peer. Napster would be peer-to-peer, but it would be with a centralized infrastructure.
Okay. So Nutella turns that
Nutella
flip side.
Was a system where you would run a piece of software and it would connect to other people directly. And then they would be, in turn, connected to other people. And you would have sort of a horizon of a certain number of hops where if someone's connected to someone you're connected to, then you can browse their stuff and, in theory, download it from them.
And your idea is that because it's completely decentralized, not only then maybe does that, it can't be shut down, can't be sued, but then also the flip side of that is it can't be a company.
Right, it can't be monetized.
Right.
So I guess arguably it could, but in this instance it wouldn't be. And the real idea of sort of how to make it work was just that you could have a finite horizon. Because if you wanted to search everyone's music and using the teller, that would never work because the numbers get too big too fast. But if you were willing to accept just the nearest 100 people or however many hops, that it would be good enough. Once I sort of had that realization, that it was it's the kind of thing that took like 2 weeks to write.
And you release it in March of 2000, and you're at AOL at this point, so you're releasing it at AOL.
Yeah, it was, I don't know. I don't know what my, I was young and not very, it was a different time. If there was GitHub, like, yeah, I would have just put it on GitHub or something. But, you know, like, figuring out how to host things at that point was difficult. And then there was the question of liability. So you made the decision to post it on AOL's stuff as opposed to that they would have to deal with it, I guess.
Yeah.
Which, you know, made a mistake. It better to do it personally just so that, you know, yeah, there might be personal liability or whatever, but at least then there would be clear ownership. But to be fair, I did develop it on AOL's hardware and dime at work, so yeah, they owned it.
Is there, being generous to you, is there maybe some sort of hope in the back of your mind that, well, it's a fait accompli once they see it and they see that it works, maybe we can get away with this after the shouting's over?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think the thing I was thinking was that, you know, forget about how things look and think about, well, you know, here's a piece of software, it's a piece of software, we can't control what people do with it, we can't have knowledge of what people do with it. So what's the big deal? Like, we're just enabling what the internet's designed to do. And they didn't see it that way.
Give me a flavor of the level of anger that, like, the sort of meetings that you probably had at this point.
You know, I think everyone was, they were pretty together about it. Generally speaking, everyone was very level-headed there. Like, my issues with how things were run at AOL were not that people would be, you know, destroying phones when they get pissed off or something like that. It was more that no one wanted to ever take. They had this, their dial-up cash cow that's making so much money. They just, you know, why mess with it? And that was, you know, that ended up being sort of a bigger thing later on where I made another peer-to-peer software product and tried to go through means of saying, look, this is a legitimate product. This is something that people want to use. And this is something we can be contributing to the internet. And a lot of people would be like, well, you know, we have AOL Instant Messenger. We don't want to, like, you know, step on its toes and that sort of thing.
You're talking about waste right now?
That's right.
But then you also did create an ad blocker program.
That was a joke.
That blocked the ads on AOL Instant Messenger.
It didn't block it. It replaced it with a nice visualization for your Winamp. And that was actually, some of that was after, well, I might have a chronology wrong, but, you know, we talked to people at AOL Instant Messenger about getting integrating, because there would be all sorts of nice things you could do if you had Winamp and AIM integrated. And at the time, people who used Winamp, like, largely used AIM. And so one of the things I wanted was, you know, when you play things in Winamp, you should be able to see your buddy list, who's listening to what, just as a music discovery thing. We never were able to make that happen. So, as an example, you know, had done that. I don't know if I did that before or after. I don't remember, but it was just, you know, throw your visualizations where the ads are. Half the time, the ads were just for AOL anyway. I was like, no AOL.
Well, we'll come back to dumb things AOL did in a second, but describe waste.
So
what that did.
Waste was something that was loosely based on some of the ideas of Nutella about having completely distributed networks. But it was built so that you would have a private network, which was all securely encrypted, where you could have typically anywhere from 2 to 20 people. And the idea was you would have this network that you could use for chat and for file transfer and browsing. And it was completely ad hoc that you could, you didn't need to set up a server anywhere. You just, a few people run it, you exchange keys. And once you have that, you can communicate with them securely.
So it's invite-only kind of?
Right, yeah. It's, you know, you had a group of people, like people who work together in a small company, you might use it for sharing files and sharing notes and for chat to coordinate and things like that. And so having made that and, like, so I spent a great deal of time on that. It was a much more thorough product than Nutella. I spent a lot of time today while trying to be like, well, we should at least release this, see what people use it for. A lot of the pushback was, well, we don't want to risk people beating AIM for this. You can make arguments that, well, this is like completely different purpose. This is for, AIM is for if you want to talk to a great number of people or a variety of people. This is like people you're really close with. But it was just it was too difficult. And there was there was no upside as far as they were concerned. Progress on the internet was not in their interest. They only saw the risks involved.
What year did you try to get Waste out there?
Probably 2003.
Mm-hmm. This is probably too cute to say, but now 10 years later we have Slack, so
yeah.
Maybe they should have realized that there were possibilities there.
Well, they weren't in a position to really take advantage of those possibilities. I mean, they put themselves not in that position. Someone asked me, I have a website where people ask me questions, and someone asked me a question about, do you regret, these different things you did with Winamp or didn't do with Winamp while you were at AOL? And I'm kind of it didn't really matter what we did there because we were ultimately not in charge of it. And they were going to not do, they were going to do the right thing for it. Yeah.
Well, so, along these lines, I think at some point while you're there, maybe not you specifically, but the AOL comes out with a music subscription product, I think in 2003-ish. And other people have said that, even if we're not thinking all the way down the road to music subscription, someone has said that, if you think about what AOL had in the early 2000s, the only thing that would differentiate what AOL had from what Apple would later do with the iTunes ecosystem is they didn't have an iPod. But basically, thanks to you guys, they had everything else in place to kind of do a similar thing to iTunes and maybe try music subscriptions and things like that. So is that, again, not trying to put words in your mouth, but maybe they were feeling their way in that direction, but they just didn't have the vision or they didn't have the wherewithal to make this sort of stuff happen or the will, maybe.
I don't know. They might have hoped that we were going to do it anyway. It's hard to say. I don't think they really knew how to make it happen. If they had come to us and Spinner hadn't been involved and said, look, we want you to build a music service and, we think that this would be a big thing. If I had said yes, which I don't know if I would have, that could have been done pretty quickly, I think. But, I probably wouldn't have said yes because I would have been like, well, we have Winamp, and I don't want to just stop working on this. And so instead, you had this big organization, and you had, I handed over Winamp development to someone else, and they started building stuff that was supposed to be, in theory, reusable for AOL to use, and things got way too complicated. I think the real thing is everyone thought it through too much. Whereas if AOL just decided, hey, we want to build this music service just as quickly and to the point as possible, it actually would have been straightforward. Mm-hmm. But having said that, I don't know if they would have had the muscle to get the necessary licensing and to make it really attractive.
Well, and it took several years of music sales going down. I don't know if in 2002 they weren't ready to talk by 2004.
Yeah.
One more thing about AOL. You mentioned that most of the ads on AIM were for AOL or whatever. How much of the classic, we gotta milk our cash cow, dial up for as long as we can. We got to dog food all of the AOL products. Point everyone back to AOL. Point everyone back to AIM and things like that. How much of that was going on?
I don't think we saw too much of that. Though we were very aware that it happened. They always talked about carpet bombing of CDs and all of that. But, But no, there wasn't too much of that. My exposure, at least.
So you leave 2004?
Sounds about ish. Yeah.
Is sort of Waste, that was your kind of, well, they're not going to do this, my time here is done.
So I ended up releasing Waste without their explicit permission. No one ever told me don't release this, they just stalled. So I released it, and they were not happy about that. And I was like, well, you never said not to. And they said, well, we never said that you could. And I said, well, I thought it was within my scope of my job duties to release things that have no, you know, IP issues, blah, blah, blah. And they were like, well, so what are we doing here? And then I said, well, I'd like to stay and finish Wingnut 5, which was probably another year away or 6 months away. So I did. And then soon after that was released, I started talking to, I forget how I got in touch with him, but David Kushner, the author, and he came to San Francisco, we hung out some. He ended up writing an article about it in Rolling Stone, and after that, they were always like...
They call you the last punk rock programmer or something.
I don't know. It was like, the headline was like, the world's most dangerous geek.
Right, right.
Not really that dangerous. That says a lot about geeks. They're pretty tame. But yeah, you're all wanted me gone. I obliged. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I stayed there for like 5 years, which is too long.
Mm-hmm.
So.
We'll end by talking about what you've been working on over the last decade. But the afterlife of Winamp. I found a stat that, like, actually the peak of Winamp usage was like 2007, where there were still 90 million active users. And I think overseas, like, because hasn't Winamp...
Most of those are probably overseas. Yeah.
But, like, Winamp was bought by somebody else recently, and, like, it's still, like, has millions of users and is generating some sort of meaningful revenue. And I don't know if there's a question there, but what do you think about that afterlife of Winamp?
Well, I hope that, you know, I think it was bought by a Belgian company that does, like, streaming radio, but I hope that it's sort of in purgatory right now. I don't think that they really are doing anything with it. I think they're sitting on it, and hopefully it'll come back to life fully.
What about the afterlife of Nutella? Because it evolved in all those different flavors. Specifically, I remember BearShare was the one that I used, but there was LimeWire, there was all this other stuff. And how did you feel about that? Because what happened? You released it, they have you take it down, but then it had already gone out to like 20,000 people. So then
And Nutella was released as a binary, so the protocol wasn't even available. And then some people who downloaded it reverse engineered it, and I think I dropped them some hints. I don't think it really mattered much the design of it, because it was such a proof of concept and so basic and flawed. It was more of just the mentality and idea that you could have a product like that, and that was influential and more important.
You know, I'm looking, we skipped over another thing that I remember, which was Shoutcast.
Yeah.
So just to do justice to it for the history books, just tell us a little bit about Shoutcast, because that was developed around the same time as Winamp.
Yeah, it was probably early on, in, like within the first year of Winamp. And Shoutcast was a streaming MP3 radio platform. And I originally made it with the idea of being able to listen to the show Loveline, which is on K-Rock. Mm-hmm. And so the idea was I could have a friend on a modem stream that to a server in Iowa, and then I could stream it from that server, or potentially multiple people could. So allow you with limited bandwidth to relay to more people than you have been yourself. So I like that was my first real network program. I think around that same time I had just added or was adding HTTP, the web protocol, streaming capabilities to WinAmp, so it was sort of by making the other side of that as well. And then I believe it was actually Tom Pepper who sort of had the idea that we could have a directory which the server, when you ran the server, could automatically list itself in this directory. And that had been done before with things like in multiplayer games, there was a program called GameSpy, which did this for Quake. So you could go and get a list of servers running Quake and then join one of them. So this was the equivalent of that for radio. And I think that's sort of like the first... GameSpy was, I think, the first like real peer-to-peer system where you have a directory and, mm-hmm. and services. And the Chatcast was that for radio. Mm-hmm. And then Napster was that for files.
Right.
Sort of, these are all of a similar concept.
Right.
So we continued to run Chatcast for some years. And AOL ran it and used a ton of bandwidth, delivering tons of Chatcast streams for all sorts of different stations. I think they looked at it as they predominantly had people downloading things on their dial-up connections, so being able to send network traffic back out to the internet was beneficial for peering arrangements.
Right. Is it Tom Pepper who was at Beats and so now he's at Apple? Is that
yes?
Yeah. That's an interesting all the way around the circle there.
Yeah. No, half of the people I've worked with are at Apple, or two-thirds are at Apple, and maybe a third are at Google, and
So, after you left AOL, is Kakos what you started immediately, and is that how you pronounce it?
Yes, okay. Yes. No, for April Fool's, we changed the C to have a D on it, so it's Sakos.
Sakos, okay.
But Kakos was a, yeah... The name comes from movie Office Space. Mm-hmm. Kakos.
Right,
except
right,
it's
right.
Not actually Kakos.
Right.
Why? But yeah, I started that and just started playing around doing different things and ended up writing a digital audio workstation called Reaper, which I've been doing 10 years. But.
Well, it's not all audio stuff, but it's a lot of audio stuff. There's a lot of stuff for musicians. And is there any theme, or is it just whatever you're interested in?
I got into playing music around the time I left, or before I left AOL. So. Actually, when I did that, when I was talking to David Kushner, we're sitting around playing music for Korea. Mm-hmm. That's how he got me to say all sorts of shit I shouldn't say.
So, Kakos goes where you go?
Yeah, it's just the... Yeah, there are two other people who are shareholders, and then we have contractors who are all various countries around the world who actually do all the real work. And
what would be the biggest program that people might have run across?
Reaper,
right?
Only if they do audio production and are one of the 1% who are half a percent or something.
Why'd you move to New York?
It's a great city.
Yeah.
I don't know, it's got so much more soul in San Francisco.
That's so funny. I have so many friends. My friend that moved to so many people are fleeing San Francisco right now. I don't mean to sound like the New York Times and be like, it's a trend, you know, but people that have done their like 10 years there and they all are coming here. I don't know. What that says, but
there are a lot of problems there. I don't think it's a terribly well run city. Hopefully they don't come after me for activating. But no, I think the real problem is that you have all these people who live there and don't contribute to the economy very much. They ride their buses to the peninsula. The way that the city's a lot of how the city is funded is they have a payroll tax, and the people who work outside of the city don't pay payroll tax. So here in New York, we have city income tax. Mm-hmm. So we have money. But anyway.
I always end with a question that has gotten to sound dumber and dumber to me over time. So I'm going to try to ask it in a modified way, which is, almost, what is it, 15 years on from starting Winamp and your whole ride with AOL, and you've seen the rise of what iTunes did. You know, basically the entire music industry has been absorbed into now Apple, Google. You know, they've lost their own, you know, independence and things like that. Now I guess we're in the streaming era. What do you think of it when you look back on 15 years? Like, you basically just wanted to write a program that you could organize your music on your computer. Now it's just an app, and you make a playlist and you pay however much a month. Like, what do you think about that evolution that you've seen over the last 15 years?
Well, you know, honestly, I think we have music services and we have all these new options, but I still just end up sitting down on my computer wanting to put on an album at a time. And so I think people, for me at least, I don't think the way I listen to music has really changed since then. It's nice that we have more options, we have more availability. The fact that we can just go out and buy an album digitally now and download it via iTunes or Amazon or whoever. I think that's fantastic. And, you know, a lot of people back in the day who were pirating music, if they could have just bought the MP3s for $7 for an hour, they totally would have. It's just that it's never on the table. So I'm very happy to see that it is.
You ever buy vinyl or CDs or anything like that?
Yeah, vinyl. If I can avoid buying CDs, yeah, I'll just get the MP3s. But having vinyl of important albums, I think.
Well, but even the concept, I guess, of buying an album in any form might be going away within a few years or so.
Like the vinyl, or
well,
just the
album ownership, full stop, in the sense that this is, again, just something I subscribe to, and I get everything. And
yeah, I mean, I personally don't like the economics of it, because I might go 6 months and not buy a new album, and so I've just spent $60, whereas...
What is the economics of that? Because you're paid per stream, but if I don't listen for a month, who gets that money?
Well, it's not even about listening, it's about... buying new things.
Right. Yeah.
Personally, I like buying an album for $7 or $10.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I don't do it that often, and I might. Yeah. Whereas paying them $10 a month to listen to the same stuff that I probably already own anyway, less attractive. Though for Discovery, it is good. It is nice that I go on Apple Music and type in James Brown and go browse the catalog and just listen to different years. Mm-hmm. Figure out what albums it is I want to buy. That's pretty sweet.
I have a very clear...
Some of those kind of lot.
Right. Well, plus, how many things are we subscribing to at this point? You know what I mean? We need a startup that just aggregates all of our subscriptions. We pay one bill. Actually, that's maybe not the dumbest thing in the world. I have a very strong memory. I know for a fact, my first MP3... was Save Me by Amy Mann, the one that was in the, what was that movie? Magnolia, yeah. So I could remember, like, literally downloading that overnight and then pulling it up in the morning in my Winamp. And, so, Justin Brinkle,
all right.
Thank you for helping me go all nostalgia on this. But thank you also for giving us the context and the history of this whole crazy musical revolution.
My pleasure.
If this is the first time you're listening to this podcast, please subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice. There's plenty more great internet history where that came from. And if you're a longtime listener, then you know what to do to help us out. rate and review us on iTunes. Because iTunes gives credit to reviews and ratings, and the more great reviews we get, the more people will discover us. As always, there's more info on our website, www.internethistorypodcast.com. The show's Twitter handle is @NetHistoryPod, and my personal Twitter is @BrianMCC. Thanks for listening.